welcome to another episode of Artifacts. If you are new to this podcast, I am your host, Rachel Wilson. I'm an elementary educator with over 20 years of teaching experience. My goal is to provide listeners with a brief blast of history and or science that offers background information and answers questions. It's my hope that listening stirs up great conversation for kids, families, and adults too. I also hope listening motivates you to chase after what you are curious about. If you would like to leave me comments, ask a question, or have an idea of a topic you would like to hear about, feel free to drop me a line at artifactspodcast@gmail.com. For more information about this episode, including a list of resources, which I should have up here in the next couple of days, please do visit artifactspodcasthome.wordpress.com. Associate yourself with men of good quality if you esteem your own reputation, for it is better to be alone than in bad company, said George Washington. In honor of the first president of the United States of America, my artifact for this episode is the quarter. On the front of the quarter, you will find George Washington. Now, I don't want this episode to merely be a timeline of the events or accomplishments of this man's life, so I've chosen a few of his struggles to research. For more information about his life as soldier and president, please visit my blog to see a list of links where you can go for more information. There are great sites out there. My students right now are working on a BioCube. And if you're a teacher, readwritethink.org has a wonderful organizer for this. It is a 3D cube that they create. It used to be something they could do online, but with the change in some of the platforms, we've been unable to use the digital version. And it worked out really well for my kids this year to be able to create a 3D cube that's about 7 inches for each face. And really put together some information about Revolutionary War figures. So my example one was George Washington. And one of the biggest struggles my students have when they are writing some sort of bio poem or a essay is, how do you make somebody that lived 200 years ago seem like a real person and not just names, dates, and places, accomplishments on a timeline. And so I've really tried to do that today for you with some of the struggles that George Washington had to overcome. And they're not all encompassing, and I admit to that. But I do think that we're going to spend a few minutes on some key ones. Well, let's get a few fun facts out of the way first. George Washington never lived in the White House in Washington, D.C. In fact, he's the only president who has not. There was no cherry tree. One of Washington's biographers, Mason Locke Weems, spun this tale of Washington admitting to chopping down his father's cherry tree. It was created to portray Washington as a perfect role model. Some of that myth has been morphed a little bit. And you could have read about this same moral tale of being an honest person in McGuffey readers as well. Washington did set the national holiday of Thanksgiving to November 26th. And my final little fact here that's off to the side, I thought this was interesting. I didn't know this before. Since 1896, Washington's farewell address is read annually by a selected member of the Senate. They then write their reflections about the importance of the address in a leather-bound book that is maintained by the Secretary of the Senate. So to get us started, George Washington was born on February 22, 1732, in Pope Creek, Virginia. Even though he started his life as a subject of the King of England, he lived his whole life in the colonies and later the state of Virginia. Washington never visited England. In fact, his only trip out of the colonies or the United States was to Barbados. Washington's life ended on December 14th, 1799, at his home in Mount Vernon. Washington was a man people would take notice of in his time. In his youth, George had reddish-brown hair. He did not wear a wig, but instead he often wore his hair in a ponytail called a queue. Later in adulthood, he curled and powdered his hair white, as was the style of the day. He weighed about 210 pounds, and he stood 6 feet 2 inches tall, which was unusually tall for a time when the average adult male was 5 feet 8 inches. He was known for his strength and his athletic ability. Many people know about George Washington and his dental problems. In fact, I read a really neat children's book to my class about George Washington and his dental problems. From the time he was 21, he began losing his teeth. By the time he became president, he only had one of his own teeth left. Over the course of his lifetime, Washington had 5 sets of dentures. A lot of people think that his teeth or his dentures were made of wood, and that's not true. His dentures were probably made of horse, cow, elephant, hippo, and walrus ivory. There is also some evidence in Washington's record books detailing 9 teeth he purchased from enslaved people for 122 shillings. We don't really know if these teeth were specifically added to his dentures. And also, just because Washington paid for them, we don't know that people willingly sold them. The dentures would have been quite uncomfortable for him because the base was lead and tin, with the teeth attached to plates. And the plates were connected together with metal rods that probably cut into his cheeks. His dental woes were not for lack of good hygiene. George used popular items of the time, mercurius chloride, which is a white, tasteless powder that contains mercury, a poison, and can destroy teeth. In his toilet set, and I know that sounds really funny, but it really is like a toiletry kit. We call it toiletry today, but in his toilet set, you can view it Mount Vernon. You can see his toothbrush and tongue scraper. He also used tooth powders made of some really odd items, such as pumice, borax, roots, and herbs. These powders could be abrasive and damage tooth enamel. Washington's tooth problems may have been the reason a 1776 Charles Wilson Peale portrait shows him with a scar on the left side of his cheek, possibly evidence of a fistula caused by an abscessed tooth. His dental problems were so severe that they may be the reason President Washington's second inaugural address was so short. It was only 135 words. And delivered in under 2 minutes. It certainly was the reason he only ate soft foods later in life. Along with tooth tribulations, Washington had educational obstacles. And I'll talk about those in just a moment. Let's hear from a word from our sponsors. All right, let's talk about Washington's educational obstacles. Unlike most of the other founding fathers, George Washington was not a college graduate. Many of the founding fathers read and spoke in several languages. Washington used one, English. Unfortunately, George's father, Augustine Washington, died when George was only 11 years old. Left with 6 children to take care of, Mary Ball Washington, George's mother, could not support the financial burden of a traditional classical education that his older siblings received. Many wealthy boys of his age would have learned several languages in addition to Latin, reading, writing, and math. Washington was embarrassed that he didn't have as much education as his peers. According to MountVernon.org, he, quote, privately admitted that he was conscious of a defective education, unquote. He didn't let this hold him back. Instead, he was determined and taught himself. He may have had private tutors and a local school for reading and writing, but he taught himself trigonometry and geometry. If you know me personally, you know that I'm in awe of that. George used his math knowledge and his experience with map making to help him in his career as a surveyor. At the young age of 16, he began his career working for Lord Fairfax. 1 year later, he was appointed Culpeper County's surveyor. This was one determined young man. In 1752, George joined the Virginia militia, where he rose through the ranks. By 1754, he commanded about 100 men and 300 militia during the French and Indian War, defending the colonists in service to King George III. Washington was not successful from the start. In fact, he lost the Battle of Fort Necessity, an early battle in the French and Indian War. However, His experience in the French and Indian War gave him firsthand experience with the British weaknesses, such as how they formed soldier lines for battle. It's this experience, along with his knowledge of colonial America's terrain from surveying, that would serve him well as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. Washington was a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses from 1758 to 1775. In May of 1775, he was a member of the Second Continental Congress as a delegate from Virginia. It was at this Second Continental Congress that George was chosen as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Congress. Of the Continental Army. Even though he'd never commanded a large army before, his peers still felt that he was the man for the job with the experience he had and because he was from Virginia. Congress was hopeful that he would unify the colonies. He accepted the challenge, serving without pay. Once again, Washington dealt with obstacles as the leader of the army. He faced poor supply chains and constantly found himself petitioning Congress for clothing, shoes, personnel, and gunpowder for his men. In a letter he wrote to George Clinton, the governor of New York at the time, Washington wrote, quote, "A part of my army has been a week without any kind of flesh, and the rest for 3 or 4 days," unquote. A shortage of supplies and a delay in pay caused many of his soldiers to become rebellious, but he persevered. One of the largest problems Washington faced was disease. In 1775, smallpox was killing off patriots at an alarming rate. It would kill 1/3 of all the people exposed to it. Smallpox is a communicable disease that comes with a host of symptoms, such as fever, vomiting, muscle pain, headaches, and pustules, oozy sores. George suffered with smallpox when he was just 17 and on his one and only trip outside of the colonies in Barbados. His life was, of course, spared, but his face was forever scarred by the disease. British soldiers were not struggling with smallpox as much because they had been exposed to it over and over again in Europe. Colonists, however, had not had as much exposure to the disease. At the recommendation of the Surgeon General at the time, Dr. John Morgan, Washington helped to drop the death rate by requiring all of his men to be inoculated against smallpox. This preventative measure was not popular at the time and not legal in all of the colonies. It involved putting scrapings of active pustules, so oozing sores, into and under the skin of seemingly healthy people in hopes of producing a milder case of smallpox and one that the person would survive. The newly infected person would be quarantined and monitored. John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail in 1777 that for every soldier killed in battle, disease killed 10. According to MountVernon.org, it is possible the death rate dropped from 17% to just 1% of all reported deaths. While his decision was definitely a risky one, it was so successful that he repeated it the following year at Valley Forge. Though George Washington was the head of a family of four, he did not have any children of his own. He married a widow, Martha Dandridge Custis. Martha had two children with her former husband. Their nicknames were Patsy and Jackie. Together, they lived at Mount Vernon, a plantation George's family had owned since 1674. George seemed to feel a sense of duty to his country, though. He longed throughout his service to get back to Mount Vernon. He had quite a love for farming. He said, "Agriculture is the most healthful, most useful, and most notable employment of man." I learned from the Library of Congress that Washington's interest in farming may have been influenced by King George III and his own affection for farming, so I want to look more into that. It is said that King George tinkered with small plots of land at Windsor. He even had articles published under his farm overseer's name. At Mount Vernon and his other properties, George Washington experimented with over 60 crops. Over the course of his lifetime, he owned 56,000 acres of land. Washington started out as a planter with tobacco and quickly discovered the crop to be harsh on the soil. A little fact for you. If a farmer planted a cash crop, such as tobacco, they were referred to as a planter. But if they planted anything else, they were referred to as a farmer. George switched from tobacco to wheat farming and fisheries, and he even developed a distillery. Washington composted, he tried out new equipment, such as plows, and experimented with a 7-year crop rotation system. The commonly accepted crop rotation cycle at the time was a 3-year cycle. So you would grow a grain in the winter, then the next year you'd grow a crop in the spring, then the next year you would leave the soil fallow, meaning you would give it a year to rest, wouldn't grow anything on it. George recorded his results in his diary, which he began keeping in 1760. His diaries recorded daily observations about the weather, field work that was being done on his land, and the progress of his many farm experiments. He wrote more than 700 pages of notes on agriculture. His own support of better publications and societies for promoting agriculture, coupled with his efforts on his own land, led him to being elected to honorary membership in Philadelphia Society for the Promotion of Agriculture. Keep in mind, at the time, the United States Department of Agriculture had not been formed yet, and he lived too far away from Philadelphia to be granted standard membership into the Philadelphia Society for the Promotion of Agriculture. This is a society that actually still meets today. Well, we can't talk about George Washington as planter-farmer without acknowledging that the real labor was carried out by the enslaved who lived at Mount Vernon. George inherited 11 of his enslaved people when his father died and went on to purchase 8 more. Then he married Martha, who came with 84 enslaved people. By the time of the Revolutionary War, the Washingtons had 150 enslaved people. Some would say that Washington privately tried to unsnarl himself from slavery. In the 1790s, he tried to sell or lease some of Mount Vernon, quote-unquote, property. What he wanted to do was use the money he made from the sales, so sometimes it is land, from the sales, to emancipate or free his enslaved people. He also wanted to buy the enslaved Dower property in order to manumit it. Okay, let me explain these terms. Keep in mind that unfortunately, enslaved people were seen as property. So Martha had been married before and her husband died. Since her children were young at the time, the enslaved people that, again, quote-unquote, belonged to her husband, were left in her care until she died. Daniel Park Custis, who died without a will, already owned these people, and they would then be absorbed back into the estate of Martha's first husband. So legally, neither she nor George could buy, trade, or sell these particular people. According to Virginia law, those people that came with her as part of her first husband's estate remained with her until her death and then were to be given to her children. George Washington was the only founding father who freed all of his slaves, technically. In office, Washington only signed 2 pieces of legislation about slavery. One was the 1793 Fugitive Slave Law, which guaranteed the rights of slaveholders to recover escaped slaves across state lines, and the other was the 1794 Slave Trade Act, which restricted U.S. participation in trafficking of human cargo. So there's 2 sides to him when it comes to slavery. You can see in his personal letters that he seems to struggle with slavery, especially when it comes to the Revolutionary War. However, he was also economically in a place where he needed help in order to keep all of his farms running. And he also had family members that didn't seem to agree with him about his views as they were changing and didn't agree with letting the enslaved people go. George Washington and his wife, though, were not laid back about escaped enslaved people. there are several instances. You can go to mountvernon.org to read about some of those. But here's one, for example. Ona Judge was Martha's lady maid. When she escaped, Martha and George did try to recapture her more than once. I think I read three different instances. They even tried using third parties to negotiate with Ona. They described her in an advertisement as a mulatto girl, much freckled with very black eyes and bushy black hair. She is of middle stature, slender, and formed delicately. I mean, they were getting pretty specific here. So they weren't opposed to using the 1793 fugitive slave law that Washington had signed into law. If you go to the mountvernon.org website, you can read of other accounts and advertisements the Washingtons submitted to newspapers, not just for Ona, but for other people who had lived as enslaved people at Mount Vernon, and they chased after them. On December 12th, 1799, Washington rode around his estate, as he often did. And as I already told you, it was many, many acres. He came home that evening and in haste, because he was a punctual man, he didn't bother to change before dinner. And as I read it that evening, the weather had turned. It was really cold. It's December. It's wet. Later that night, he complained of a sore throat. He had some sort of throat infection that was probably an acute bacterial infection of his epiglottis. That's that little U that hangs in the back of your throat. And it could have been caused by strep. Many of us have had strep throat before, but we get the pink stuff that makes us all better in a few days. Unfortunately, the pink stuff, antibiotics, had not been discovered yet. So the common treatment of the time was put into action. He lost approximately 40% of his blood due to bloodletting, which he supported. It had worked for him before. The practices of the time were supported by the medical community. Unfortunately, there were also other very uncomfortable treatments that he agreed to as well, such as enemas and drinking strange concoctions that seemed odd as I was reading them. Things like putting apple cider vinegar down the throat of somebody who already has a sore throat. I can't even imagine. Finally, on December 14th, he had what was to be his last conversation with his secretary, setting out his final wishes for burial. Interestingly enough, he didn't want to be buried for 3 days. I'm guessing because he wanted them to be sure he was good and dead. He asked his secretary, "Do you understand?" The secretary gave a yes, and Washington spoke his final words, "'Tis well." George Washington died between 10 and 11 p.m., surrounded by his wife, physician, and friend, Dr. James, along with his personal secretary, Tobias Lear. As I said before, in his last will, he did offer freedom to the enslaved people that he personally owned. Of course, he couldn't offer that for Martha's dower property, and she was actually unwilling to free the people that he had offered freedom to until she was convinced that they weren't out to kill her, poison her, whatever the case may be. And then she kind of decides that maybe it's better to go ahead and free them than try to keep them with her but free when she had these dour enslaved people that were going to be forced to stay with her. But she does end up transferring some of them to her grandchildren. I thought that was interesting. So definitely different views on slavery from him to her. Well, I think we better put a lid on this episode. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for listening. Please consider subscribing to my podcast. Leave a review so others can find it. And please feel free to email me if you have questions or if there's something that I said today that you think you want to know more about. I'd love to continue researching for you. Have a great week.